Keep it very short, I guess. Maybe I want to start out by explaining why René and I wanted to invite Tracy for the Translating the Humanities research project. When I was looking up Tracy Deer, I went to the Resolution Pictures website and I saw something very interesting that said when it was referring to gaming and virtual reality, two components of Resolution Pictures, they were the tab was called Minority Media. And immediately I thought about the translation concept that we have in cultural translation of minority translation, where we focus on the power dynamics between languages and the points of view that they represent. So that made me think of Mohawk Girls and the presence. I think everybody's seen at least a couple of episodes, the presence in the episodes of Ganyengeha, of English, of the French, the different languages. And I guess I, maybe to start off, that'll be a question. How important is language to your filmmaking? And as you know, one of our first presenters in February was Aguirre Tega Martin, who worked as a translator on Mohawk Girls. So we're both in the context of many languages in a series and the practice of translation in them. And more broadly, there's often been a comparison that's been made between Mohawk Girls and the famous TV show Sex and the City, which was hailed at the time as a show that was pushing boundaries of representation of women, but it was still a dominant representation of women. So I think we might be able to think about it in terms of comparison. Just as we compare translations, we compare texts, we can compare Sex and the City and Mohawk Girls to see maybe that's a sort of translation of how Mohawk women navigate their world and how different it is from what we can see in a show like Sex and the City. So with that, I'll...
What a great opener. I'm just ready to talk about that. Hello, everyone. Really happy to be here. Thank you all for taking a look at my show. This is the first time I've actually been invited to talk to a translation linguistics class. So I have some things to say, and then I would very much like to hear what you guys are interested in, because I do want to talk to your interest. I'm going to go off of what you've just said there. I'm a huge fan of Sex and the City. When it came out, it really spoke to me. I just adore those characters, the situations, the frankness upon which they spoke about relationships and sexuality. Like, this was all brand new for TV at the time, so really, really inspired me, entertained me. But at the same time, you know, living in Manhattan and buying $500 shoes was not something I was doing. It didn't matter. I was still able to relate to the women and the experiences, but when I would compare it to my own reality, of I grew up and I still do live on the reserve. Ganawage is just 15 minutes from here. The experiences were so different, and in some ways, you know, our relationship politics were so different. In my community, I'm related to like half the men there, so navigating who's my cousin and who isn't my cousin in terms of the dating world is very different than what Carrie, Charlotte, Samantha, and who am I missing? Thank you, Miranda. Very different than what they were going through. I was early in my career when I came up with the idea for Mohawk Girls. I was doing documentaries, and I do want to talk a bit about those documentaries in a moment, because I've done a number of documentaries now, all in indigenous languages, two of which are not my own, and one of which is my own. So I will like to speak about that in a moment. But I was in my documentary career. We were up north doing One More River, and we were traveling from one Cree community to another. There's nine vast distances between the two, and One night, we were traveling from one community to another. Should have been about a 3-hour drive, but we were in the middle of a blizzard. So we could only drive about 10 kilometers an hour, and we had zero visibility. It took us 9 hours. And my co-director, he's a strong, silent type. So we made chit-chat for about half an hour, and then just went into our own sort of spaces. So it was 8.5 hours of very scary driving, and no one to speak to. So I thought, oh, this is a great time for me to brainstorm. And that's when I started thinking about all the very hilarious things going on within my own world. I was a young 20-something girl myself. And like my dating tribulations and my sisters and my cousins, like all these crazy things that were happening to us, I ended up sharing it with my co-director and saying, you think that's funny, right? Like, that's funny. And he's like, that's crazy funny. So I started making notes over the years of just all the crazy things that were happening in the lives of me and my friends. And I think 8 years later, when I hit a bit of a block in terms of my documentary work, I couldn't come up with another idea for a documentary. Documentaries take a good 3 years of really living with the subject and having the responsibility of the people in those films really in your hands. They give you their soul and you have to decide what to do with it. It's a lot of responsibility and it's very stressful. So I couldn't come up with another idea, and months went by. Months went by and I sort of sat there and just ended up deciding that let me try fiction, my hand at fiction. When I was a little girl, 12 years old on the reserve, I used to disappear into movies as a relief from the various negative things that were going on around me. I had just lived through the Oka crisis. I'm kind of jumping all over the place. So far, so good?
Yes.
Okay. Does everyone know what the Oka crisis is? Okay, great.
No, we don't know.
Okay. Very quickly, in 1990, there was a land dispute over a sacred burial ground in a neighboring Mohawk community called Gunnisadage. It's about 45 minutes from here. The town next door, the non-native town, felt that they owned that property and they wanted to level the forest and build a golf course. The Mohawks felt that land belonged to them, and there's a burial ground, century-year-old burial ground on it. So they said, no, you can't do that, and they set up a peaceful protest so that they could not come in and bulldoze. That lasted a good 4 months until the mayor of Oka eventually said, okay, enough is enough. Send in armed forces to remove these protesters. And that ended up exploding into an armed conflict on both sides. And the Mohawk people armed themselves and said, we will protect this ground till the end. And the province said, well, you're a terrorist and that is not okay. And then my community in Ganawage realized the danger of that situation because Gunnisadage is a very small community. So Ganawage, being so close to Montreal, we also got involved and we ended up shutting down the Mercier Bridge. We put about 100,000 commuters, we denied them access to Montreal to put pressure on the province to make sure that nothing happened to our brothers and sisters at the other reserve. The whole thing lasted 78 days, an entire summer, and a lot of really ugly, scary things happened that summer. And it did end up getting resolved after millions of dollars were spent on the part of the province to put armed encampments around us, and we got the burial ground. So we did win in the end. So I was 12 during the Oka crisis.
I wrote about you, and I found that history, but I didn't know the reason.
You didn't know the?
The reason why.
The reason why, yeah. Okay. So I was 12 during the Oka crisis, and it also happened to be the year I decided I wanted to be a filmmaker. And so it's all coming full circle. The reason I disappeared into movies is because I had just lived through the Oka crisis, which was a highly traumatic experience for me as a little girl. And it's the summer I realized that I was different, that I was an Aboriginal person. I started to understand what that meant. I started to understand that that's not a good thing in this country. And it was very confusing. I think at any age it's very confusing, but definitely I was a child and I was no longer a child after that summer. So, and that happened to also be the time when VHS machines came out in the market. So up until that point, you had to like go to a movie theater to see a movie, but now we could watch them in our homes. It was so exciting, but nobody could afford these things. So my father used to rent them on the weekends, and he would rent about 15 movies all weekend. All we did was sit there and watch movies. After a few months, my mother and my sister got kind of bored, but me and my father, we would watch all weekend, just movies, 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 and I just loved going to these different places and experiencing different parts of the world and meeting different characters, and going along on these characters' journeys actually allowed me to feel again. I think I had shut down, I had some post-traumatic stress, and as a Mohawk person, we're taught to be really tough, and when you're tough, you don't have feelings. So movies gave me the permission to have feelings, because when I cry, I was crying for that character, wasn't crying for myself. So it was then, after movie, every movie inspired me to be that thing. I wanted to be the fireman, I wanted to be the adventurer, I wanted to be the archaeologist. And after a number of months, I finally realized, wait, if I made all these movies, I get to experience all these stories and maybe inspire little girls out there to be the scientist to find the cure for cancer. But I get to just tell all of these stories. So I was 12 when I decided I wanted to be a filmmaker. But I ended up falling in love with documentary in university. I am now coming full circle to the fact that I had documentary block. Man, I'm rambling. And so it was after documentary block that I thought, let me go back to my love of fiction and see if I, as a director, that I have that skill as well. And that is when I made a short film based on all the ideas I had come up with about crazy relationships, and that short film was pitched and became Mohawk Girls the Show. And we're in development now on our fifth season. We start shooting that in about 2 months. So that's how the show came to be. That's a little bit about who I am. My whole career has been telling stories of my own people. Growing up, I never saw my people on television or on the big screen, unless it's historical. I mean, Dances with Wolves, right? That's still good, but that's not what I look like anymore, and that's not what I do. I'm not on a horse anymore. So there is a place for Dances with Wolves, but there's also a place for our current reality. And that is what I've been really interested in telling stories about and sharing with Canadians, but also, I hope, challenging my own people for us to self-reflect on where we are we happy with where we are, get dialogue going within my own community, get dialogue going in your community, and get dialogue going between both our communities. That's the overall goal of what I do. In terms of language, I've had quite a bit of experience now telling stories in Aboriginal languages. My first film, One More River, was about the Cree of Northern Quebec. And many people up there, Cree is still their first language. And that is not the case in my community. That is not the case in a lot of Aboriginal communities. There's only a few languages that are still strong, and Cree is one of them. So for a Mohawk girl, who I did learn Mohawk, Mohawk immersion, so I was 7 years old until 12, I was in Mohawk immersion on the reserve, but as soon as the bell rang and we left the school, I wasn't speaking it outside the school because my parents were all denied learning it, and my grandparents were all beaten when they spoke it. So when all us little ones who were going through this language revitalization movement, when we would leave the school, there was just nowhere else to speak it. So it's deep, deep inside me. You know, I know that that base is there, and I don't have my own children yet. I hope to have some at some point. And it's very important to me that this is something I pass on to them. So it's on my list that I need to be able to pull it back out. I know the base is there, because I think language is so crucial and key to a culture's identity. It really is where it all stems from, and if we lose it, we start to lose our place. And not only that, I think we also start to lose our
heritage.
That's good. But what I'm looking for is we begin to lose our okay, I can't think of the word, so I'm not going to be eloquent. The way Canada sees us, we start losing our language. Canadians can start saying, well, you're not really real, you know. So it's very vital that we keep this alive. So myself and many of my colleagues, you know, there's a lot of that we're producing a lot of things that are in the language, because that stuff is there forever. And it's a resource to learn from. And for children and for adults, I mean, TV and film, I mean, it's a joy. It should be a joy. It should be a place that you go to enjoy. But ideally, you're also like learning a whole lot. So that's what I think we're all hoping with all the things we're producing with the language, is that it's able to contribute to that. That revitalization. One More River was pretty much predominantly in Cree, because that was the first language. And so I am a filmmaker going up into this community as an Aboriginal person myself. So that kind of got my foot in the door. But I didn't speak Cree. So I'm filming interviews, I'm filming real life events, all in a language that I don't understand. And I don't always have a translator with me either. So what I found very interesting for myself, I really developed, I think, a lot of instinct, story instinct, and really I had to start connecting with people based on feeling. So how they're speaking and what they're speaking about and what their body language is when they're speaking in a language that I don't know, I was picking up on all those cues to help me understand, like, oh, he's... And what's also very interesting is, I mean, we're all different, so the cultural norms you grew up in with in your homes, all of you, all different. And in my home and in my community, we are loud. We are loud, and we're mad, and we're angry, and we don't mind saying it. So that's when I see anger, that's what it looks like. But the Cree, the Cree is a completely different type of social structure. And they don't get angry like the Mohawks get angry. So it was very subtle. It was in the eyes. So there were times where we're filming. We had open consultations, kind of like this type of room, and people would get up to the mic to share their thoughts on an issue. And we're filming it, and sometimes my co-director was there, and he spoke Cree, and he is Cree. So in the beginning, they're up there, and they're talking, and you know, I'm trying to figure out what's going on, and I'd ask him, like, so is he supportive? And he'd look at me, he's like, no, he's really upset. And I'm like, he's really upset. He's like, yeah, he's really, really upset. And I could not, it was not my kind of upset. So I had to then understand, like, okay, well, what's going on? Where is the upset happening? And in the staccato of the way he was speaking, that started to indicate to me, like, that, oh, okay, that's angry. So that was a really, really interesting experience. And then editing that story together was, again, very, very long, very tedious. I mean, you can, in English or in a language that you have, you watch an interview, you understand, and you're moved at certain parts. They say this, and you're like, oh, that's good, let me mark that down. It's much different to, and so what ended up having to happen was everything was transcribed, translated and transcribed. And then I had to read the transcript and look for content that was interesting, and then go back to the interview and watch them, knowing what they said, to kind of get an indication on whether that was the moment or not. And so you have to go through 12 of these moments, let's say, and then be like, okay, that's the one. And then you pick that one. And then at some point you get somebody to come in who speaks Cree to watch it and see if it all kind of makes sense. And sometimes they'll lean forward and be like, oh yeah, that's good. And then other times they're like, that doesn't make any sense at all. So, and then they help me to like make sure I add one more word on, or, you know, it's like we made the cut at the wrong place and we cut them off mid-word. So yeah, it's a really big challenge, but I was really honored, privileged, and really in awe of seeing an Aboriginal language alive and well. So that was an incredible experience. I then had the experience to make a film about my own language, Ganyagaha, a school in Agwezesne that is run completely by parents to teach kids not only the language but the culture. It's called the Freedom School. And I was a co-director on that as well, and we did like a year in the school. What does it look like for the kids in this school? What does it look like for a school run entirely by parents? How do all these parents agree on curriculum and agree on problems and fundraise for those for that money? It's all run by fundraised money. So a huge effort, a real grassroots effort. And in this situation, my co-director is Cree, so he doesn't understand Mohawk. But I'm Mohawk, and I had immersion when I was a child. So I felt such pride at being in that school and having the language alive all around us, and I understood it. So that was wonderful. And as the year went on, I started to find my language again. So by middle of shooting that documentary, I was then able to start asking my questions in Ganyagaha instead of in English. And that was a huge moment for me. I'm very, very proud of that film. I also went down to Hawaii. Mushkeg Media, who does a lot of films and television programs in the language for the Aboriginal People's Television Network. They did a series called Finding Our Talk. I believe it was 3 or 4 seasons worth. Every episode was a different language in a different community, and it was all about revitalization efforts, the incredible revitalization efforts happening across this continent. Actually, I think they might have even went to Australia and New Zealand as well. I did not get to go on those ones. But I did go to Hawaii. So I had the Hawaiian episode, and I got to go down there and look at the incredible things they're doing down there. And you can go all the way in university up until your master's and get your master's not in the Hawaiian language. There's a number of programs where you could get your degree in, but you can learn it. You can learn that content in your Aboriginal language, in Hawaiian. So that's astounding. And that, again, was a very, very humbling experience to go in and be able to document these efforts and these people speaking this beautiful, beautiful language. And again, I had no idea what they were saying, but I did have a translator for most of it. And that's its own challenge because, you know, in an interview, you want to develop rapport. You want to connect with the person. You want to really be listening to them. And I never do an interview with questions. I did at the very beginning of my career because I was super nervous. But really, it's about listening to the person, connecting with them, and having a conversation. So the question thing, you're never going to get to the real heart if you're just going, okay, thanks, and then you go to another question. But when you don't speak the language, that they'd share something, and then I would need a moment for the translator to lean in and give me the gist of what they said. And very quickly, then I had to formulate sort of thoughts and questions based on the summation of what they just said. And sometimes they've just cried. They've just shared something, and they've cried. And so very respectfully, I, you know, need to maintain eye contact and sympathy, but they're leaning in to kind of tell me essentially what was just said, and so then I have to come up with another question, but you just never want to leave them. You never want to go, okay, what was that, and make notes. So challenging. And a very, very special experience, and I'm really, really proud of that episode too. And that episode ended up winning an award at a festival for, and it was a festival specifically about languages. So I was really proud of that. And then Mohawk Girls. We do put Ganyagaha within the show here and there. Some characters speak it. But the reality is in my community, a very small amount of people speak it. You met one of them, Agwira Deka. He's phenomenal. And there are many young people like that who are really taking charge of making sure that this language survives. So it doesn't make sense in my show to have everybody speaking Ganyagaha. So we've chosen a few characters and made sure that in terms of their backstory, it makes sense that they speak it. So their mother, one has a mother who was a Mohawk teacher. So that Mohawk teacher made sure that her daughter had it. One has a really close relationship with her grandmother, and her grandmother speaks it. So, but it's not all over the show at all. But we do have a Mohawk version of the show, which is what Aguidadeka spearheads. And what's been interesting in that process is a lot of the conversations that happen in the show about sex, about asshole boyfriends, about, you know, beating up some girl. These are not the typical conversations going on back home in Mohawk. You know, the Mohawk language, where it's being used in the home with children, you're talking with elders, you know, you're not talking about your sex life back home in the Mohawk language. So Aguidadeka, Aguidadeka translates everything. And so he had to often find ways to say what the girls were saying. And he had to go talk to some elders and say, you know, this is what they're saying. And I won't even say what they're saying. Dirty. But he had to go to elders and say, like, so this is what's happening, and she's saying this. How would I say that? And, you know, everybody's sort of scratching their head, and our language is very descriptive. So it's not a direct translation. And so he had to come up with ways. And the bigger challenge, which I'm sure he talked about, is in dubbing a show, you need the mouth to move with the words. So I can't have my mouth closed and the words keep going on. As a viewer, you're going to be disturbed by that. So not only did he have to translate everything into Ganyagaha, he also had to translate it in such a way that it fit the English moving mouth. That's crazy hard. Crazy hard. So impressive. So he translated it, and then we had a number. I think we have about 12 Ganyagaha speakers who have been cast to play the parts. So I'm really proud of that too, because often when you dub a show in an Aboriginal language, there's usually a woman and a man. And a woman will talk all the women parts and a man will talk all the man parts. And it takes away from the enjoyment of the show if everybody sounds the same. So we really wanted Mohawk girls to try to, the Mohawk version to be just as enjoyable as the English version. So we have one speaker cast for one role in terms of all of the leads, and for the smaller roles we have like the one man who covers all the other small man roles and one woman who covers the small woman roles here and there. So all of these different speakers had to then come in and now not just deliver the text, they had to act with the language. So if there's a big girl fight going on and somebody's yelling, "You skank, I hate you," they had that first, they came in and they're reading the line and it's just, "You skank, I really hate you." And I'm like, "Ah, we need a little feeling. You're gonna have to." So it didn't take them long for them to then be like, to get into it. But yeah, so now they're yelling out lines that they've never before ever and would ever say in Mohawk. And doing a really great job at it. So, and there's a whole bunch of kinky sex in the show, and so the actress, the speaker who plays those roles, I know she like giggles the whole time when she's in these kinky sex scenes that she has to moan and then giggle and then say something in Mohawk. Yeah. So I'm so proud that the show has a Mohawk version. For two seasons, we were also carried by the network Omni, and they translated two seasons into Mandarin. So that too was an incredible experience to watch my show and everyone speaking Mandarin. So I think that covers sort of all of my involvement in terms of language and you know, my different experiences with language in the show. this might be a good time to just see if I'm on track for what's interesting and if you have questions.
So the show is not translated in French.
It is currently not translated in French, and I would love it to be translated in French, but we don't have a French broadcaster. And so typically, it's the broadcaster who requests other languages and will then pay for that to happen. So APTN requires English and an Aboriginal language. Omni required English and Mandarin. So that's why all those versions were made. And we would love to be on a French network here and have a French version. But we don't have that yet. And that would probably be easy. Like, that's a breeze after Mohawk and Mandarin. Any other questions?
So what language do you speak?
Like every day?
Yes.
It would probably be English mostly, but I have just married...
Being 15 minutes away from Montreal, it's going to be English and not French?
Yes, and I can tell you why.
Yeah,
so,
very interested in that.
So Ganawage, we speak English.
Okay.
It's like an English enclave.
Okay.
And this goes back, real historically. We were never allied with the French. We were allied with the English. So we fought the French. And then ultimately, we have been manipulated by the French over the years in terms of where we live. And I mean, everything has been decided upon by the province on how we live. And the restrictions with which we've lived by. So there's been a real oppositional relationship with Quebec. And so when I was growing up, the attitude that I received in the community and was taught very subconsciously, nobody ever said to me, you have to hate them and don't ever speak their language. Nobody ever said that to me directly,
yeah.
But it's in the air.
Yeah.
And so it was like our way of protesting this province by not learning their language.
Nice.
Now I bring it up in the show, like the only one really hurting by this big protest is us, because we can't leave the reserve for work. Mm-hmm. You need to be bilingual in this country, in this province to work. So we have high unemployment rates, but we have very smart, able-bodied people. We have a lot of people with degrees, but they speak English, so they cannot get work off the reserve. I'm happy to say that this is an attitude that has been changing in my lifetime. You know, in the last 20 years, I've definitely seen changes. We now, one of our elementary schools started a pilot project that puts children into French immersion for 4, 5, and 6 for parents who would want it. So they started it to see, is anyone even gonna want this? Sure enough, parents were like, yes. So that is ongoing. We also have a lot of parents who are sending their kids off the reserve for elementary school and sending them to French elementary schools because they're getting the English at home,
yeah.
And they want to make sure they have the French. So I have across the street from me a young family of six little children, 3 sets of twins.
Oh my God.
The mother is a twin maker. Every time she has children, they will be twins.
Oh my God.
She's not having any more. She's like, I'm done. But they're so cute. And I think it's like 8, 6, and 3. And she's sending them all to a French immersion elementary school. She's a young mother. She's younger than me. She's in her early 20s. And not early 20s, late 20s. And I was so impressed that she decided to do that, because it's certainly frowned upon still by many. So you're really bucking the trend when you say, no, I'm going to do this for my kids. So these 3 sets of twins play in the yard across the street, and they're very happy, rambunctious kids. And every so often I hear French, which it would never have happened in my neighborhood growing up. And I am, and so now you're asking me what I speak. So. And it's something I've always felt, it's always been a deficit for me. I've always felt defective because I couldn't speak. I've grown up with the idea that I'm not worth much. Like, that's what this country has sort of taught us. And so I have set forth to prove that I am worth a lot. And I think I'm doing a pretty good job at proving that. but the French thing has always been for me something that still I feel is a deficit for me. And so I've been trying to learn, but my big learning has actually happened in the last few years because I ended up falling in love with the Francophone. And he's completely bilingual, but French is his first language. And he, when I met him, his son was 5, and his son only spoke French. So the only way for me to connect and interact with this little adorable boy was to brush up on my French and get better at it. And I remember asking my boyfriend, who is now my husband, you know, you need to talk to me more, I need to learn more. And it was just so easy for him to speak to me in English and have real moments of connection with me in English, because that's easier for me. So my teacher was the 5-year-old and the 6-year-old and the 7-year-old. And so over the years, my French has gotten better because of him. And then he became 7 and he still didn't have any English. But my family is all English. And so, and my family wants to connect with him, but it was just a struggle. So we have since put him in now a school that has 10 hours of English a week. It's still a French school, it's a private school. And within a year, he now has perfect command of the English language and is a bilingual little boy, which we're really happy for, because again, in the bigger world too, he needs his English.
Of course.
So I speak English primarily, Mohawks speak English primarily, but in my home there's French as well, and I'm proud to say I'm getting better. I'm getting stronger. Yeah.
Good for you.
Thanks. Yes?
You said you were married, and do you all live on the reserve with your son?
We do.
With his son? Your husband's son, sorry.
Yes.
Yeah? And is that a problem for some people?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
There's actually an article that just came out a few.
Yeah.
CBC put an article out in a podcast. I did a podcast, and it came out on Monday. So if you want to learn more, you can look up Tracy Deer CBC, and that'll pop up. But yes, now that I have married a non-native person, I have broken, like, the law. And according to the law, I am no longer a Mohawk of Ganawage. I guess I'm just a Mohawk floating in limbo at this point, which is really hard. It's still really hard to process that and be okay with that my community rejects me, doesn't want me. But I found this amazing person, and love is super important, and so is happiness. And so, yeah, it was really tough. It was not a tough decision. That's wrong. It was an easy decision, but the consequences are really tough.
Yeah.
So I'm still figuring that out now, but he's worth it.
I saw your documentaries of really a few years ago, and recently I saw the series Mohawk Girls. I couldn't stop when I saw it.
You watched the whole thing?
Yes. Yes, I was really amazed how you used comedy to even as form of sitcom, I should say, to communicate. To translate what it was, because through your documentaries, I could already see what it was to be a Mohawk girl's woman, and the difficulties. But it was, I don't know, it was from the outside. I was,
right.
Oh, yeah, it's difficult. But with Mohawk girls, it was like you brought us within there. And it's just then that I realized that it was just so close from Montreal, and then I knew so little. I just it's computed a lot more through the series. I was like, wow. So I wondered, what is for you the way that communicates the best way for you to communicate, to translate what you the identity? Is it through documentaries? Would you go back to documentaries? Would you go back to fiction? What is the best way for you?
Well, one, I'd like to say thank you so much for the feedback, because that's exactly like what I hoped we would do with the show. Our tagline is "Welcome to our world." Like, we really wanted to bring people in to experience it as we do. I think the media often paints it with just such a superficial picture. Not only my community, but all Aboriginal issues. It's really like, oh, look at this terrible thing happening again. But there's so much context as to why that terrible thing is happening, and there's so many layers and there's so much history that is involved in that terrible thing. It's not just, oh, boo-hoo, look at that terrible thing. So we really hope with the show to, yeah, really bring people in and say, like, look, it's not easy. It's not easy. What is Kermit the Frog saying? It's not easy being green. It's not easy being Mohawk. Like, it's not easy being Aboriginal. So here it is. Take a look and just, yeah, some compassion would be great. And I think compassion going both ways, we can really get really far. So here's my thoughts on documentary versus fiction. There's only so many people that will watch documentaries, unfortunately. And it's a certain type of person. People who watch documentaries are open to exploring new issues and places and people. Like, it's a certain personality already that's going to be, and they're already quite open to the topics, is my experience. But fiction, especially television, you get to get into people's homes. You get to go where, for them, it's really safe. Their living rooms is really safe, and they have the power to just turn it off if they don't want, and nobody sees them turn it off. So for me, getting into people's living rooms is like the place to go. And in order for them not to turn my show off, humor, comedy, lightness. I don't think people are going to watch a dark, depressing show about Native people that just might make them feel guilty or bitter or annoyed. And by the way, we turn on the TV to like escape the things in our own life that make us bitter and annoy us, and we turn the TV to like have a break. So I don't think I would ever make a dark, gritty Aboriginal show. I already live that. Like, why do I want to make that show, you know? And who wants to watch it? We see it on the news already. So for me, the power has been in the comedy, because I think that lets people's walls down. And when we can laugh together, when we're inviting people to laugh with us, at us, I mean, some of the stuff we're doing and some of the things like the girl fighting and putting up with some of these loser guys, yeah, laugh at us. Laugh at these characters. And I think characters as well. Like, you can fall in love with a character and root for that character and relate to that character. And I think that's also a really powerful way in. So with both my documentaries and the fiction shows, for me, it's always been about character, because you want to get into somebody's heart. And the way to do that is through a real person, even if they're a fictional person. Within the show, they're still a real person. They're real. And they have their flaws and they have their strengths and they make their mistakes. And ideally, you can relate and then root for them. So right now, I'm in the fiction universe of things, and I'm really enjoying it. And the impact I'm finding has been much greater in the fiction universe with Mohawk Girls. You know, we were quite certain we were going to have an Aboriginal audience. And we really, really wanted to get a Canadian audience. And we have. So we know that there's a large cross-section of Canadians who are watching the show, and that's fantastic, because then that means there's some walls coming down, there's some bridges being built. So I'm feeling like fiction is a more powerful space right now.
The reach is larger.
Yes, the reach is larger. And as a control freak that I am, fiction really satisfies those urges. You know, I get to control every single aspect of it, whereas in documentary I have no control whatsoever, which is its own sort of skill that I think I've developed, but it's just so great in fiction. I mean, the color of salt and pepper shaker, you know, they'll come up to me and be like, we have seven, which one works? And then I have to think, which one would Zoe pick? This one. Every single thing you see on the screen, I've chosen. You have, like, every single thing. The rug, the chair, the table. Everyone comes to me and says, which one, Tracy? So when you're watching TV, hopefully you're not noticing that. You're not noticing the salt and pepper shaker. But everything comes together to create a universe and to create a vibe and a feeling, and hopefully it sucks you in and you just go for a ride. So that's what I love so much. Trying to do anyway. And it sounds like I got you.
Are you, now that the show has been working and is having fame and stuff, are you maybe thinking of doing like a movie? Or
yes.
Yeah?
What a great question. So I've done documentary, I've done television show, and the one thing I haven't done yet is a feature fiction. So for me, it's now like the new challenge for me to try to tackle. I've been writing script for years. It's about the Yucca Crisis. It's a coming-of-age story of a 12-year-old girl during the Yucca Crisis. Mm-hmm. So I want to look at the Yucca Crisis from the point of view of a child to really get at what the themes there were. And it was about David and Goliath. And I think within our lives, we have David and Goliath struggles all the time. It doesn't have to be the army and a burial ground. So the little girl has a bully in her life, and she has this David and Goliath struggle in her small world as the big world around her is exploding, and she's being pushed and pulled throughout it. So some of it is pulled from my own experience, but it's definitely fiction. It's not my own experience. And it's been a long process to write this script because it's so close to me, because I want to get it right, because some of the scenes have been very hard for me to revisit within my own memories. So I'm able to find every possible excuse to procrastinate and not do it, and I'll just do it tomorrow. But we have a first draft, and we actually just submitted a bunch of applications now to get money to write second draft. And I'm really happy with where the first draft is. I'm feeling really good about this film, and if everything goes well, we would be shooting that next summer.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. Who's gonna, not invest, but who's gonna help out? Is there a big television, a big show that's supporting, or how?
So in this country, much of what's on TV is all publicly funded. Mm-hmm. So production companies apply to, there's a bunch of funds that we all have ideas. Networks want our ideas. As long as the network says, yes, I want it, then we all apply to these funds and we all compete with one another. So I have a producer, and the producer does all that stuff, all that boring stuff. That's what she does. I come up with the ideas. I'm the creative person. She's the business person. So she gets the money. She tells me what she needs. She gets the money. And when she has it, she tells me, go make it. So there's a number of funds that she would be going to fully finance this film. And we're anticipating it'll be about $3 million budget.
This is a promising project since it touches also the Canadians and the...
Oh, yeah. I think a lot of these... I think they're going to be thrilled with it, actually. Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you.
Also the show. It's very cool.
Thank you.
I watched a few episodes with my girlfriend. It's pretty good.
Does your girlfriend like it?
Yeah, she loves it. Yeah.
Awesome.
We're both entertained by it. I still haven't finished it, but I will.
Cool.
I have a question.
Yes.
You're talking about your upcoming movies and the shows you've done. Have you seen a change in the landscape as far as Aboriginal artists and filmmakers are concerned? Do you find there's more stuff coming out?
Yes.
Is it easier to find funds, or are the funds drying up? Or
Oh, well, we have the Aboriginal People's Television Network. You guys know what that is, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they came into existence now, what, is it 15 years? And really, from that moment onward is when really the like Aboriginal storytelling renaissance has happened. And that is exactly when I got out of university. So I've been there sort of from the beginning. And so it's been incredible to see how much we've grown in only 15 years and the quality of work we're putting out there. And every year we have new emerging storytellers. We have a number of film festivals that are all focused on Aboriginal work. So there's definitely, like the demand is there, the space is there. But what's great is like we're really on the cusp of crossing over now into the mainstream. So there have been a number of successful shows on APTN that have matched the same quality
like
of
yours.
The bigger networks. Like mine. Mine's one of them. But APTN has done a number of really, really great shows that quality-wise can be on any of the other big networks. And in fact, and Canadians are tuning in. So this idea that the bigger networks have had that, that's for Aboriginal people. Like CBC, it's always been like, oh, it's all about Aboriginal people. Well, that's for Aboriginal people. Go to APTN. The idea that Canadians will not tune in is no longer an argument they can make because Canadians are tuning in to APTN to watch. Or honestly, it's streaming. Mohawk Girls is all streamed online, and so our biggest audience is people finding it online and watching it online. Mm-hmm. But they're able to see where the IP addresses are of everybody coming to watch, and it's not reserves. So I think we're at a time, and with Truth and Reconciliation going on, the bigger networks are. They're open right now. They're open, and I think they're really. It's going to be soon. I want it to be me, but it may not be me. It may be somebody else, and that's fine because somebody just has to cross over and helm a big show on one of the big networks. And it doesn't have to be all Aboriginal people, but there has to be Aboriginal people in there, and not just one Aboriginal person who only shows up to talk about Aboriginal. Spirituality, like they have to be real characters working with other real characters, and I think it's going to happen. Like I think it's soon. It's my prediction. So, the environment is getting better. It's getting better all the time. I'm very hopeful, but I have to be hopeful, and I'm an idealist, and I have to be hopeful because there's so much negative. There's so many barriers to break through that if I looked at those. Then I get it when people go, oh, why bother? Mm-hmm. So I don't look at those. So it's going to happen. Mark my words. Yes.
In the Mohawk Girls, you talk a lot about problems within the community. And a lot of those problems come from the law of identify you as Mohawk and what do you have to do to still be a Mohawk.
Yes.
And we can see that it's a big problem in everyday life. So do you feel that more and more maybe young people will feel the burden of those laws and that it might like soon maybe like change because it's becoming too difficult to handle? Do you feel like that?
That is my hope. I mean, that is one of the reasons why we were talking about all those things in the show. Again, I make these things not just to entertain, but to get us talking and thinking and self-reflecting. I mean, we live it every day, and it's just this reality. And I don't know if we're often sitting back going, God, this sucks, you know? So I hope that I'm a part of a movement for change. I hope that the show can be a part of it. But that being said, you know, it all really depends on what you're being taught. So there are young people who are more open-minded and more confident in who they are, and they don't need blood purity, and they don't need the mass approval of everyone to know who they are. But there are definitely families that are still teaching their children to hate white people, and white people are bad, and white people are there to hurt us. And it's also tricky with our history. Like, we're never gonna forget our history, and it's important to know our history, but our history is so dark. And it's dark, it's always dark at the hands of white people. So I remember as a young person learning about it and learning about everything that's happened and knowing that that was like my great-great-great-grandmother and that could have been my mother and it is me. Like at the Oka Crisis, I had people throw rocks at me. It's a heavy burden. The history is a heavy burden, and there are times where I felt tremendous guilt at the idea of like letting go of my anger, because then is that what's the word I want? Is that disrespecting what my people went through and survived if I let go of that anger and move towards somewhere brighter? I've had lots of therapy, and I am now completely okay with, like, I'm sure you can tell I'm not an angry person, right? And I think the future of my people is dependent upon us healing and walking a brighter path. We cannot stay in this angry place, but I totally understand why it's really hard to not let it go. And it's not that I've let it go, but I'm not letting it pull me down, you know. And all of Canadians, like you in this room, are not guilty of that happening, you know. And you right now have the position and the choices now to make things better for my people in this country with what you say and what you think and or what you don't say or what you don't, you know, what you don't do. You have choices. So it's not okay to blame the past on the people of the present, but that there's a big responsibility on the people of the present to also rise up to the occasion to make this a different time. So in answer to your question, I think there is some movement, but I also think there's a lot of people still really trapped in a very dark, painful place. And it's a part of like my challenge is to, in my work, is to help pull people into a place of healing. I'm always trying to figure out how to do that, and I think art has its part in that, and I hope that I am a part of that in whatever way I can be. And I have my voice too, so I share a lot all the time about what I've gone through and sort of my own healing and my own therapy. And I remember when I first went to therapy, I was so ashamed because I grew up thinking it was very weak, feelings were weak, I'm supposed to have it together. So it was so shameful when I first started going, but I was in a depression and I was getting close to being suicidal, and I knew it and I needed help. So I found some, and now I've been in therapy for 5 years. I think I'll be in therapy forever. I just love it so much. You should all go to therapy. You don't have to have, you know, a very, very traumatic past with people throwing rocks at you. It's just, we've all experienced things as kids, our parents, our this or that, and yeah, it's just so great to work through those things. So I'm a big proponent of it, and I share with my people whenever I can sort of the benefits of taking care of self.
I was going to ask you another question.
Yeah.
I guess when I was watching Mohawk Girls, I was wondering if all the issues that were addressed in the show were issues you wanted to bring up because they were sort of unspoken, or if they were, like, for example, like Zoe goes to therapy and is kind of reticent towards it.
Yes.
Or everything else that the community laws or how everything you were talking about, blood quantum, all that stuff. So what I'm kind of led to believe is that, from what you're saying, is that people don't talk about it a whole lot. And so what you were trying to do was kind of like push boundaries and bring these issues to the forefront.
Right.
And so my question is, what's been the feedback from the Mohawk community and from outside of it?
Yeah. On a whole, I don't think my community really likes my work. They didn't like my documentary. They liked Mohawk Girls, the documentary, which was about three teenage girls all sort of sharing their experiences. They all got really behind that. But they didn't like Club Native, because Club Native deals with blood quantum and this membership issue. And Mohawk Girls, you know, here's the thing. I told you we're really opinionated, right? And we're really loud. But we're also, we're a small little fishbowl of a community. And it's one thing to stand up to, like, the enemy. It's another to speak your mind to your neighbor. So, I haven't actually had many people come up to me and say anything negative about the show. But I've heard through my sources about a lot of the negative things people are saying about the show. I also don't have a lot of people coming up to me and saying positive things about the show either. Like, but every so often, I'll hear a little something from somebody positive. Like I said, I've never gotten anything directly negative, but I know it's out there. And so I can't tell you whether it's like half-half or 10% like it and 90% hate it. But I know the criticism I'm receiving is that some people are... We're very sensitive to our image in the bigger world. And there's a reason for that, because our image up until this point has really been controlled by non-native media, up until APTN anyway. And it's always been wrong, it's always been negative. So my critics say that my show just gives Canadians more fodder. You know, I'm airing our dirty laundry. But if you don't look at the dirty laundry, if you don't put it out there, it just stays dirty. So I feel it's better for us to like look in the mirror and decide. Like if it's dirty and we don't like it and we don't want people to know, then maybe we should take care of it, not hide. So that's my position. But there are people who feel like I'm making us look bad. My answer to that is, I really do stand by the fact that my show is very authentic and true to life. All those characters exist in real life. All those situations have existed in real life. Like, so many scenes are pulled directly from my life. So I can stand by that and say, this show is true. It may not be, you know, my neighbor down the street, it may not represent their experience of the community, but it represents mine. And I've been there my whole life, and I can stand by that show. So if you don't like the way we look, then we need to look at what we're doing, because this is the way we are right now. So that is the challenge that I put to the critics of, it's not enough to hide the ugly. We have to deal with the ugly. But across the country, we've heard a lot of positive feedback from Aboriginal people. I think everybody's having like a really good romp at it. Like, a lot of people have said, oh my God, our res is just the same, ha ha ha, kind of thing. Social media is great. We're getting like a lot of feedback through social media. Or we get feedback like, oh my God, all the guys here are assholes too. What's wrong with these native men? Kind of feedback. So that's great, you know? Yeah.
Were you surprised of that reaction on your people? And also, do you think that is related maybe of you marrying somebody outside and not having that's not okay for them. So then you, whatever you do, it's like...
Right, I'm like an outsider. So I only just married the guy. I married him Labor Day weekend, this last Labor Day. So okay. When I started this, I married.
The man and?
Well, I said Labor Day weekend. That's when I married him.
Okay.
So what, 5 months ago, 6 months ago?
Yeah.
6 months.
So when I started this whole thing, I was a Mohawk of Kahnawake. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it has anything to do with that. Mm-hmm. But now they have that, they can throw on it as well, if they like. Your first question?
Were you surprised?
Oh yeah, was I surprised? Not at all. Mm-hmm. Not at all. I know my community. We're lost in many ways. So I was not surprised, and I was definitely expecting some people to hate the show. And that is absolutely within their right, and I did not make it thinking everyone would love it, and you can never please everyone. And if you do that, if you try to do that, then you're not being true to yourself as an artist. So, and I'm okay with it. Lots of therapy, lots of therapy to get me to a point where I'm okay with my community being upset with me and not approving of me and being critical of me, and now, you know, not wanting me. I'm still in therapy, but because it's not easy. But I would rather speak the truth than
be accepted by them.
Exactly. Then hold my tongue and be accepted. That doesn't work for me.
Everything is changing, and my feeling is that what you are doing in your community will affect others in the future. Maybe you won't see, but it will change. And you are just the beginning of a change.
I hope so. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You said your marker was translated into Chinese and into Mandarin. Have you had any feedback from Chinese communities?
No. Whatever feedback I think would have come would have gone directly to Omni, the station who was broadcasting it. And Omni never reported anything back to us. Yeah.
Just a very quick question, and maybe it doesn't have a place, but the therapists that you see, are they Mohawk?
No.
That sounds like a silly question, but because of the uniqueness of what you're experiencing, of what you experience as a Mohawk person.
Yeah, I hear you. There's not that many Aboriginal therapists, psychologists, you know, so I don't even know if we have one back home. I think we have a child psychologist who's Aboriginal. That's such an interesting observation, because I've had people ask me that before, mm-hmm. but what I found really interesting, well, one, my therapist is Jewish, so she's able to relate within her own experience and culture to my own, which I think almost makes it more powerful, because again, it's building these bridges to a human experience, not
a common human
experience. Not a bubble, not some kind of very specific bubble, but it's about our emotions and our inner strength and getting over pain, and I think that journey for anyone, regardless of whether you were assaulted or, I mean, it's sort of the same process. It's just the circumstances are different. So, the reason I also think it's been really good for me is because sometimes I will bring up, but the community, you know, but the rules are this, and what about blood quantum, and my children, and then she'll say, okay, wait, let's just put a pause on that for a second, like, and then she'll bring me back to, like, forget all the noise for a second. What are your values? What is important to you? And that has been my guiding force through it all. And it really is, sometimes it's a lot of noise that is trying to push me off my path. Mm-hmm. But that's not to say that my people and my culture is not right where my path is. But it's all the noise and the fear and the pressure and the intimidation, like all of that has to sort of get pushed to the side. And she helps me kind of center back on who am I and what's important to me. So I think it's been okay.
Mm-hmm. Are you sometimes tempted to go live outside the reserve, or you feel like you've got to stay and fight your place there?
You guys have really good questions. okay, so. So I might cry.
You got me to cry. I usually cry like once per presentation. Like if somebody asks the right question and on the drive in, I was like, oh, I wonder if they'll get me to cry at this one. And so far it was going so well. I was like, I don't think they're gonna get me to cry. But okay, good question. So I am absolutely a fighter. I'm Mohawk. Like I have been raised to fight. I have been raised so well by my people to stand up for what I believe and to fight and to have a voice. And even when it's standing up to them. So my attitude has always been this law is wrong. And it is not okay that they're telling us who we can love and who we cannot love and who is worthy in our families. And telling our children of mixed race couples that you are less than, like that is not okay. So my position has always been to stay and fight and make them push me out, whatever that looks like. You know, what is that? I don't even know what that looks like. I mean, I have a house. They're gonna have to take my house from me and I will take them to court and I will do all those things. But I now have this very innocent, sweet stepchild. And I want to have other children. And they shouldn't have to live that. So if it were just me, and if it were just me and my husband, because my husband, my French-Canadian husband, completely supports me and is understanding, thank you, and supportive, and all of those things. So he has said, like, whatever you want to do, I'm there. So he would also be ready to sort of fight this all the way. And I'm a filmmaker, so I would, like, document it all, and I'd have five films.
Gosh, water.
Thank you.
but yes, the children aspect of it, and you know, I grew up in this community, and I grew up. My blood quantum is 89.63%, and I grew up feeling less than because I didn't have 100%. I grew up shameful of my great great grandfather. Who's French-Canadian, as a teenager, I hated him. I hated that my great-great-grandmother married him. And, I mean, this was during the post-OCA and hormonal teenage years. And I just wanted to be 100%. And then I finally got through a very dark place and saw how disgusting that is. That I'm here because of that person. I'm here because that man and that woman fell in love and had children, who then had children, who then had children, then had me. So that is disgusting that I would be taught to hate somebody that gave me life.
And that was just 10% deficit. Not only that, you know, there are all the social issues that you hear that happen on reserves. They are actually there. Those are not lies. There's a lot of really beautiful things happening too, but there are a lot of really rough social issues. There are a lot of people who are in a lot of pain. They are mean. They are bullies. They want to pull other people down. So, I mean, I grew up, I feel like I survived my childhood. My adolescence, childhood was fine. I was playing in the mud. It was fine. Adolescence, I had to survive. And my first bout of suicide came as a teenager. I was 15 years old. I think a lot of it had to do with post-traumatic stress from the OCA crisis. But also this message I was receiving from the outside world that, you know, like, you're worthless. Don't have dreams because they will never happen. And the message I was receiving from my community as well was, don't have dreams because you cannot go out into the outside world. You have to stay here. So everyone was telling me there was no point for me being on this earth. So at 15, I really was in the space of like, why even bother? Thankfully, I got through that with some really great friends in high school. I went off the reserve for high school. And this wonderful, wonderful girl that I admired from afar took an interest in me. And I felt was for the first time somebody who saw me and didn't judge me and wanted to know me. And she really saved my life, but she doesn't know it. So it was hard. It was hard to grow up on the reserve. And I know how hard it is. And so that too plays into my mind of, I know how hard that was. Am I willingly gonna let my kids survive it too? I don't know what life on the outside is gonna look like, and I'm sure it's hard too, but I don't know that. I don't know what hardships are gonna be there. I know what hardships are there. And so there's many levels where I'm like, no, it's important. I do need a home off the reserve. So we do have one. We made that decision. Well, I made the decision because, as I said, my husband was willing to support me either way. And I made the decision that we would get a home off the reserve as well, so that in that place would be safe. There never would be an angry mob showing up. Our children would never be in the front yard and be yelled at by somebody driving by in a car that they're half-breeds or that they're French or get out. Our other home is safe, and that's so important. So we have two homes, and I hope to maintain both homes, and I hope to raise my children in both places and for them to be connected to their community and all the wonderful things that it is, and that they are raised knowing the responsibilities that they have as a Mohawk person, but that they're also a part of the bigger world too. I want both those things. So that's what we're gonna try to do.
How do you come to 89%? Because I thought we said it's either one or zero or half.
That's the Indian Act, uh-huh. But they have something different in California. Okay. They have a lot of quantum.
Right. Right, exactly. So the Indian Act, I mean, that's its own sort of set of rules. But blood quantum, the way it was measured before, I won't talk about now, but when I was a kid, basically they would go back, that we have a church. Ganawagi was a mission. So we have records that stretch back quite far because of the mission. So they'll look at your ancestry, and basically it's just a mathematical equation. And for my family, maybe they have it, they have 30 ancestors back, but for my neighbor, they might only have 10. So they used what they have to start dividing and dividing and dividing and dividing. And that's how they came up with 89.63% for me and my sister. It was in some division, calculation, stretching back however many ancestors they had their hands on. And so my mother is 100%. And it's on my father's side that I have the great-great-grandfather who's French-Canadian. So my mother would be 100%, and my father would be something else. I don't know my father's blood quantum. In the 70s, maybe? So then if you divided his number with my mother, you get us, or something like that. Yeah. Now it's mostly you need to be 50% or more. So you can't get a document anymore from the Bank Council that gives you a specific, it's a document that'll just say she is more than 50%. But I have my document, it's in one of my documentaries. My first documentary, my certificate with my number is there.
Well, first of all, I want to say that I really enjoyed your show. I watched the whole thing.
Yay! Thanks!
I think it's a nice balance between comedy and serious issues. And I can't wait for season 5.
Yay!
And also, my question was, is there a particular reason that your main characters are all women? Do you think that men and women go through different things?
I am a woman, and so I can speak. I don't know if I can. I think guys would need to say whether their experience is different. I think it is. I think it is very different. I am a woman, and I am interested in our experiences as women. All of my films have always been about women. And it's a voice and an experience that I can speak about very authentically, with confidence. And my experience of my community has been like as a woman. And the dynamics in the show, since you've seen the whole show, right? There's a very, very clear dynamic between the men of the community and the women of the community. And so I skewer the men a lot in the show and go after them for their behavior, and I challenge the parents on how they're raising the men. But if a male Mohawk director wanted to make Mohawk boys, I would be totally interested in seeing how he would portray the male experience in the community. And I'm sure he would have there would be their beefs against the women. But I'm interested in women. Yeah, we're awesome. We're awesome and we're underrepresented. So like our voices need to be out there way more on television, on the big screen. So I want to be a part of that and making sure we get up there 50% of the time, because that's still not the case. Yeah.
I have, regarding the Mohawk girls' identity, you have most of your work is a representation of this identity. For you, is it, and there's many facets, would I say, many representations. For you, is it a quest to your work, or is it all those layers? Is it a work in progress to define what is the Mohawk girl's identity? Is it something that you want to show the world? Is it something you want to communicate? What is the Mohawk girl's identity, and what is your connection?
This is like the best audience I've ever had. These questions are so good. So, yes, all of my work, including the documentaries that you haven't probably seen, like have all been about A+, right there. I'm giving her an A+. It's all been on identity, so yes. And the reason it is because I am on my own quest to figure out what does it mean to be a Mohawk woman in this very global modern world. I am still trying to figure out what does it mean for me. Who am I? What are my responsibilities? Is it okay that I'm with a French-Canadian husband? Is it okay that I'm going to have children that will have mixed parentage and that I'm going to live off the reserve, but I'm going to bring them home? And what, you know, I have my critics back home. You know, they tell me I'm whitewashed. They tell me I'm assimilated. I'm whitewashed. I'm a traitor. So is that true? Am I doing something wrong? Like, I'm just constantly sort of questioning and trying to find my space and be able to hold that space. It's also why I'm still in therapy. Like, I'm, you know, it's a really difficult question. And everybody has a different opinion on what it is. Like, you, those of you who have really watched my show, everybody has an opinion on, like, do this, and then you're Mohawk. Don't do this, because then you're not Mohawk. Do this, do this, do this. And we have some characters who are trying to do all those things to be the good Mohawk. Yeah. And that is the struggle that so many people are on right now. So that's why I'm so fascinated by the topic, and I don't know what the answer is. Like, I don't have... I can't yet paint the picture of what it, of what is that identity, but I'm getting closer to what it is not, I think, and that is what this exploration. That's why I'm so interested in this exploration, and I do think as a people, our issues across the country as Aboriginal people, so much of it does stem from this identity crisis we're having. You know, we are now in this modern world. Many of us have lost our language. We're dealing with just basic survival in some reserves. You know, there's no drinking water. There's 15 people living in a house. There's no space there to understand who we are in this world. And on top of that, we're persecuted for who we are, like with the racism and the bigotry. So there's an identity crisis happening, and it's the cause of so many of our problems. Like, when you are not right with who you are, when you have self-confidence issues, when you have self-esteem issues, when you have worthiness issues, that's so much pain you're carrying. Of course, you go to a substance to numb that pain. Like, it all comes down to that. And it's so important for us to figure it out. So that's why I keep talking about it. We'll see how many more films I can, like, if I can do another 20 years on the topic. Hopefully we, you know, but I think we're getting stronger all the time.
I'll keep watching.
Okay.
Earlier you mentioned you had some feedback from across the country. I think you meant Canada. Have you had any feedback from the States and stuff as well?
We are not in the States.
Oh, okay. So only
not yet. Okay. We have a distributor, and the distributor is in charge of selling the product to other countries.
Because I'm sure, like, you're going to have, like, feedbacks. Because there's a lot of communities there.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I really want to get on Netflix. That's what I want to be on. They've expressed interest, so there's discussions ongoing, but yeah. What time is it? Oh God, wait, what time is it?
20 to 8.
I have to pay my parking. Oh, give me 1 second. I don't have to run out, it's just right here on my app. But I
Well, we'll probably wrap it up if there's no more questions, so you don't have to put too much parking.
Yeah. But it expired right now. So.
Oh, shit.
That I don't understand is why Canada is so open to the immigrants and they are excluding their people. I don't understand that. Because we are all immigrants. We are all with different language, with different culture. That's the reason that when I made my choice to talk about the translating the reconciliation, I don't know if I could transmit my message, but why, when we are talking about the translation, it's not just translate a language. We need to understand the feeling, the culture, and it's not the history of your community. It's the history of Canada.
Yes.
And we are not different parts. We are just one. One part. Almost if we speak different language, almost if we have different culture, we are just one. And that's the message that I tried to pass when I was talking about reconciliation. You can't talk just about language, because it would be just words and words can go. You can go. You need to go deeper. And last time I was telling you that everything is changing. And almost when the first minister is telling something and it looks is. Political, the discourse is something different, is something new. And in our countries, that I was telling Rene when I arrived, we have more than 500 years, and our actors all disappear in my country. I don't have. And I when I was a child, I was hidden the Spanish. And I don't know if I have an ancestor, I indigenous or not. And I needed just to accept my that I was maybe mixed, that I maybe have, but I was hidden to one just because the weight of the colonization arrived and all my, that I feel that is my people disappeared.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I'm more Spanish than indigenous, but I realized that they are just one. And we are part of them, of the Spanish and the others, and it's just with acceptance that we can do a change. We can stay in the past, because if we stay there, we can arrive to the future.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, and the acceptance of everything, how it was, about our history is the only way that we can go away. And that's that I was telling you that that you think maybe you feel inside yet, but what are you doing? It will be a change in your community and not just in your community. When you, I saw you, the Mohawk girls, I come from another culture, completely different, but I feel so identified because I was doing the difference inside my family and I was fighting all the time and I needed to get out of the country. And I was excluded of my family because I was the difference.
Yeah.
The different one inside. I didn't follow the rules.
Right.
But I will be connected to my origin all the time. And I'm working for them each time that I'm healing myself and I'm doing something better for me, I'm changing. For all, I'm doing some change for all of them. Almost if they don't understand is the way that it's acting. And I feel so, when you were talking about your feelings, the connection have to be here, not in a language. You don't need to understand a language. That's the reason that you understood the Greek. You don't need to talk the language
mm-hmm.
because you were connecting here.
That's right. That's how we need to connect.
You just enter in that, if almost if you don't know the language. And it's the
that's,
only
that's
way.
The universal language,
yeah.
is emotion. Connection and human emotion.
We don't need to translate a language. We need to feel and to take the place of the other and
yeah.
just acceptance. We have a lot of histories everywhere and we need a lot to heal. But the only way is acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
When, what happened, and don't judge if it was okay or not. It's part of you.
Mm-hmm.
But your first question was, if Canada is so open to immigrants,
why
have that position?
Because they didn't accept their own origin.
Yes, but I won't go on.
Oh, what?
No, your question, I just wanted
to
refer to your question and see her answer.
Or maybe,
or
why?
That is a whole nother seminar, I think. I can give a whole nother presentation on that one.
There. Invited people come here. And if you go to each community, they have their own, they continue with their own religion, with their language and everything, and we can work here. Almost like I was saying, it's not legal. You need to forget your permanent residence, like you need to talk French. But I know that I have a lot of friends from India, and they are working here, and they don't know any word in French.
Mm-hmm.
They just speak English. But they are working in Montreal.
Mm-hmm. Which is harder. It's harder.
I have a question from Catherine, and maybe then one more question, and then we'll wrap it up.
Okay. I just wanted to thank you because your show is very great. First of all, I binge watch it. And
yay! Another time! Thank you!
And I'm really looking forward to for the next season.
Awesome.
And also, like, I wanted to say that, like, you were really inspiring as a person today, but also the show was very inspiring because I grew up not next to Kanawake, but really close, and like we would pass through Kanawake all the time, and it was just really high opening to finally see the community
okay.
for real and it was like knowing a whole different world, but at the same time I could relate to the characters so much, and because I come from a small community, there were a lot of material there as a being a woman also in a relationship with men I could connect with, and so it was, I really loved the show, and I'm telling all my friends to watch it.
Thank you. That is such great feedback, you have no idea. It's like the your feedback on the show, I mean the show, all my films, like they're my babies, those are my babies right now, and
to get that type of feedback, it just, you have no idea how happy it makes me. So thank you so much.
I really hope it will be translated into French soon, because I think that around Kanawake there are a lot of Francophones that
speak
English, and they have to, there's a need for a dialogue and for them to get to know, or really stop with the prejudice and just...
Well, even I think the whole province, especially in terms of reconciliation, you know, I mean, the Oka crisis was 25 years ago, but that was a big, big deal, and it formed a lot of opinions in this province, opinions that have stuck. The mother of my stepson is terrified that her little boy is at our house 1 week out of two, because that's where we live, terrified. She will not come on to the reserve to pick him up because she's terrified. So I'm like experiencing this firsthand, and she won't speak to me. But I can't, I'm like terrified? What? That's crazy. But she's terrified. So I think for the entire province, like, it'd be so great for the show to be in French, and for it, like, I think it could really be a part of the reconciliation process.
And you were talking about babies, so I have a baby question.
I might cry. Yes.
You were saying that your husband is very supportive, and so he's French Canadian, and I was wondering about, like, because my boyfriend is from a different culture as well, and so, like, what are the, are there challenges? Like, were there challenges for him to get to know your culture, and like, were there some difficulties, like cultural translation that was going so easily? And when you were talking about having children, so.
I know. That is still, I'm still not sure what that looks like, because clearly his culture is important and my culture is important. So we've talked about it a few times, because I've been curious to know, like I will absolutely sort of take charge of making sure they know their Aboriginal roots. And I said, and what about you, honey? Like, do you feel strongly about making sure they know their Quebecois roots, you know? Because I don't know what that means. Like, what is that? Is it a certain kind of, is it food? Is it language? Is it dance? Is it community? Like, what on his part would that be? And he, you know, he kind of thought about it, and he was like, yeah, it's going to be important. And I'm like, okay, well, like, what is it? I'm so curious. Like, what is that? And he wasn't sure. He's like, I'm going to think about that. And I was like, well, what are you passing down in that regard right now to Mathieu? Because he has an 8-year-old boy. And he couldn't answer that either. So it quite often we take this stuff for granted. You know, we're just living. So what that's going to look like, I'm not sure. Like, it really will be, I feel like the responsibility does fall on him to the degree that he wants to. Because I certainly can't teach the child about their Quebecois roots, because I don't have them. I don't know them. So I know my responsibility, and it's going to be really important to me to make sure. And he is completely supportive. It's interesting. It's almost like he really reveres, like, where I'm from, and understands, like, how sort of precious and special it is. Like, he wants to learn Mohawk. He wants to learn so that he can also be a part of making sure Mohawk is in the house. And I absolutely want to make sure our house is trilingual. But he's going to be in charge of making sure the kids have their French. We haven't decided, like, do the kids go to French school for elementary and then English school for high school? Or do they go to English school for elementary and then French school for... Like, we're still sort of negotiating that. So that's the amount I can tell you about sort of the cultural exchange sharing. Was there another piece of the baby question that you were asking?
Also more about you two together. But you said that he wants to learn Mohawk.
Oh yeah, that's it. Yeah, he. So the one divide, I would say, between us, and it will always be as such, is, like, he'll never have an Aboriginal perspective on the world. And he's learning. He loves to learn about our culture, and he asks questions all the time. And he's reading books and he's learning history. Like, he's so open. But the one thing we'll never share is our perspective on the world, how we see the world. This is my second marriage, for you to all know. You're really getting to know me tonight. And my first husband was Mohawk. And I have to say that shared perspective on the world was something that was really comforting. There was almost a shorthand in the way we were able to speak about issues, situations, because of the way we both experience the world. And so that is something that is lacking with my husband and will always be lacking. But what's interesting and what it allows me to do is, again, it's helping me to find my voice in explaining the Aboriginal point of view of the world, which is what I'm always seeking to do in my work. So because I have a husband who now is like always asking questions or doesn't understand why I'm so upset about something, and then I have to tell him, well, so sit down. I'm so upset because this happened and then this happened and then they said this, and he's sitting there going, oh, I see why you're really upset. That's terrible. So I have to do a lot of sort of context now for him. Whereas if I'm with another Aboriginal person, we're just both sitting there going, can't believe this happened again. And we all are like, yeah. So that has its benefit too. And I see it as beneficial to like my work as an artist, you know, and knowing what, through him, I know what other people don't know. When he's like, but why do you think that? And I'm like, what do you mean, why do I think that? It's not obvious? And he's like, no. And so then I have to explain. So it's great to have a reminder of what people don't know. And I take for granted because I know it and I lived it and I live it every day. So there's that one thing that'll be missing, but you know, I really believe in always looking to the bright side, and the bright side is he keeps me on my toes. And he helps me to learn how to share and invite people in to better understand what the experience is. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll go up.
Yo, me, thank you.
Thank you for your generosity and your frankness. I think there's a whole fan club of watchers for Mohawk Girls out here. So thank you so much. You've been a great inspiration to everyone. And I don't know if you want to say something.
Thank you.
Well, thank you guys. Like, this has been...